That was Matthew chapter 12. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were hungered and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, "Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day." But he said unto them, "Have ye not read what David did when he was hungered and they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them that were with him, but only for the priests. Or have ye not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, 'I will have mercy and not sacrifice,' ye would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath day." Jesus says, in this place is one greater than the temple. We serve a Lord who is worthy and is great. And this account here, in this story that we just read from the life of Jesus and his disciples, it describes a controversy when Jesus and his disciples were being accused by his enemies, and Jesus, in answering them, refers to a story from the life of David from the book of Samuel. And it's in the chapter we're about to get to. But let's take a moment and look at what happens here. It says that on the Sabbath day, Jesus was going through the corn. Jesus was taking his disciples through the corn. His disciples weren't doing anything that Jesus hadn't led them or taught them to do, but they were doing what Jesus himself had shown them. And it says his disciples were hungered, and they began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. Now, this seems pretty innocuous. Why would there be anything wrong with what they were doing? Well, it was on the Sabbath day, and under the law in the Old Testament, you were not allowed to do any work on the Sabbath. And by the time of Jesus, the teachers of the people had spent years, had spent generations discussing and thinking about what was allowed and what wasn't. Where was the line between work? Because in the law, it says you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. So people that are minded to think that serving God is about figuring out the exact particulars of where the line is and everything, spent years trying to understand, well, what is work? What constitutes work? And so they had all kinds of regulations. They had, you were allowed to walk on the Sabbath, but there was only a certain distance you were allowed to go. If you went beyond that, it was considered a violation. And so they see what his disciples are doing. Now, if it hadn't been a Sabbath day, they would have not seen any problem with this. In fact, what the disciples are doing is in accordance with the law. In the book of Deuteronomy, it said that in the land of Israel, you could go into your neighbor's field, and you could, if your neighbor had a vineyard, you could take some grapes off your neighbor's vine, and you could eat them. Amazing. If your neighbor was growing corn, you could go into your neighbor's field, and you could pluck their ears of corn, and you could peel them, and you could eat, and you could feed yourself from your neighbor's crops. And so there was always a means. God had provided in the law a means by which, if the people followed the law, no one would ever have to go hungry in the land of Israel. Even if you didn't have a good crop yourself, you could go and you could feed yourself. What you were not allowed to do is you were not allowed to take a container into that field and fill it up with your neighbor's goods. Then you'd be harvesting your neighbor's hard work, but you were allowed to have enough to feed yourself so you could go. As long as you didn't take a container, a bag, a case or something and fill it up, you could go and you could have as much as you needed. And we see that they were also taught, here's another thing, they were also taught that when they harvested their fields, they were not supposed to harvest the corners of the fields. They were supposed to even leave some area so that the poor would have something to glean. And we see this, for example, in the book of Ruth. Ruth, who was the great-grandmother of King David, Ruth was at one time a stranger, impoverished, and hungry, and she fed herself by gleaning from the fields of Boaz. So this is what the disciples are doing, but what they take issue with was not taking the grain from their neighbor, but from doing it on the Sabbath day. And Jesus' response is quite revealing about how we ought to see God, God's law, our relationship to God, because it's really comes down to something so fundamental about how the view of the leaders of the people, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, their understanding of God was so far from the truth. They read the law, they read the law, and then they read the writings and the teachings of the rabbis over the generations, and they had some kind of conception that God must be so particular about all these little details of the law, and that's how you please God. And in the doing so, they totally missed the point of what God was teaching them. That God was, through the law, teaching them about his righteousness, about his qualities, his attributes, and the attributes that people that follow him ought to have. And they were missing the point. And so here they say unto him, "Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day." So they're making an accusation against Jesus' disciples. But of course, what they're really doing is they're attacking Jesus. By attacking his disciples, the people that followed him, that were doing what he told him, they were attacking him. They're accusing him. And here's how Jesus responds. Now, he says unto them, "Have ye not read what David did when he was in hungered, and they that were with him?" So he goes to this story in Samuel. And I think this is telling too, because Jesus could have said, they're not breaking the law as it's written down in the Bible. They're violating the interpretation that the elders over the generations have had of the law, but they're only violating what you have added to and not the law itself. But Jesus doesn't say that. Jesus doesn't say that because that's not really getting at the heart of what was most important. It wasn't about the particular right interpretation of where the line of what was work and what was not work. It was about the character of God and what is really important. So he tells this story. "Have you not read what David did when he was hungered and they that were with him, how he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests?" So David is going to eat bread that's holy, that's set aside. Now this showbread, what this was God had taught them in the law, he taught the priests that every Sabbath day, they would take 12 loaves of bread, and they would make 12 loaves of bread, and they would offer that as a sacrifice to God. By after they'd made the bread, they would put it out, and they would put it out in the presence of the Lord. It would be in the temple, it would be in a holy place, and it would be set aside, and it would stay there all week. And that bread was offered unto the Lord. And then at the end of the week, it said that the priests, and only the priests, were allowed, after this bread, which would have been stale by that point, was taken down, only the priests were allowed to partake of this. But David ate, and his men ate this bread in apparent contradiction of the law. So why was that okay? It makes us think. Maybe it's because feeding the hungry is more important to God than that regulation. Maybe it's because David is greater and more important than that regulation. Something to make us think, to consider here. He goes on, though. He says, "Or have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" Well, you weren't supposed to do any work on the Sabbath, but if you go back and you read the law and the instructions, and you read about what the priests were doing on the Sabbath day, the seventh day of the week, when everyone was supposed to rest and no one was supposed to do any work, the priests are doing all the work. They're offering the sacrifice. They're serving in the temple. And Jesus himself, he doesn't deny that they were working on the Sabbath. He says they profane the Sabbath, but he says they're blameless. And then Jesus begins to get, or continues to get even more to the heart of it. He says, but I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. Interesting how Jesus justifies. He doesn't justify himself by arguing the minutiae of the law. He justifies himself and his disciples by saying he's greater than all of those things. That he's the Lord of the Sabbath himself. That he is greater even than the temple. And then he goes to this verse, which is really gets to the heart of it. But if ye had known what this meaneth, he quotes the prophet Hosea. He says, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. Ye would not have condemned the guiltless. The disciples had no guilt for what they were doing. And if they understood that God, the character of God, and the desire of God is for mercy above and beyond the sacrifices of the law, if they understood what was important to God and God's character, then they wouldn't have condemned the guiltless. It has to do with the purpose of the law, why God gave it. I heard this analogy in describing this, which I really liked and I thought was insightful. If you've been a parent or are a parent, you have many rules for your children when they're young. You have many, sometimes very specific rules. Now, you might make a rule that you say when they're older, you might say, if you're out, you need to be back by 10 p.m., and if you're here at 10:01, you're late and you're in trouble, you're grounded. You might be very specific, and you should be very specific. Or when they're little, you might say, every time you go near a street, if you're going to cross the street, you have to hold my right hand, and you cannot even start to walk across that street until you're holding my right hand. And you would make those rules. Why? Because you're trying to protect them. You're trying to help them grow into maturity. But it isn't ultimately about the specific of the rule. It's about your character and what you want. Now, if you overheard, now let's imagine you overheard your children one time talking to their friends about what you, their parent, are like. And you hear them talking about you, and what they're saying is, yeah, my dad, he's so picky. If I'm home at 10, that's okay, but if I'm home at 10:01, I'm in big trouble. My dad is just so particular. All he cares about is that if I hold his right hand when I cross the street, but if I hold his left hand, I'm in big trouble. And if you heard that, how would you feel that that was the impression that your children had gotten of you? What would you think? You would say, they'd missed the point. They did not understand your character at all. They were so focused on the law that you'd given them and trying to interpret it and trying to figure out how to live by it that they missed the point of who you are and what your character is. If they instead said, what's your dad like? My dad, he really cares about me. He doesn't want me to get hurt. When I was little, he always made sure that I held his hand when I crossed the street. He wanted to keep me out of trouble so that I'd learn maturity and learn truth, and so he had a curfew for me, and when I went out, I needed to make sure I was home by a certain time. If you heard that, you would have a different impression of what your children were saying. And the scribes and the Pharisees in Jesus' day, they did not have the right conception of God. And so Jesus is turning them back to what God cares about. God cares about mercy. He gave the sacrifices to teach them things, to instruct them. The New Testament tells us it's our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. And there Jesus is. The whole point of the law, the whole point of the sacrifices, the whole point of the Sabbath, everything there, the whole reason for all of it is right there. And all that they can focus on is the law when the fulfillment and the purpose of all of it is right in their presence. All right, let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 21 because this is what Jesus refers to here. And this is quite an amazing story. from the life of King David. Before he's been ultimately set up as king. In fact, this chapter, chapter 21 of 1 Samuel, this begins right after David flees with the help of Jonathan. David flees from Saul, so David's now a fugitive from King Saul, who wants him dead. And what's going to follow, what we're going to see in the chapters to come, are the things that transpire when David is on the run from Saul, in hiding from Saul. David's a fugitive from Saul, and we're going to see what unfolds in David's life and in his path. And it's quite amazing. So 1 Samuel chapter 21, let's go ahead and read. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said unto him, Why art thou alone, and no man with thee? And David said unto him, Ahimelech the priest, The king hath commanded me a business, and hath said unto me, Let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. Now therefore, what is under thine hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in mine hand, or what there is present. Now, is this what happened? Did David get sent on a mission from the king, from Saul? Well, no, David's given this story when the reality is David's on the run from Saul. David's a fugitive from Saul, and Saul wants him dead, but he tells the priest that he's on a secret mission. And the priest answered David and said, There is no common bread under mine hand, but there is hallowed bread, if the young men have kept themselves at least from women. And David answered the priest and said unto him, Of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. So the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread that was taken from before the Lord to put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. So what it's saying is the only bread that the priest had there was the showbread. It must have been the Sabbath, because the priest had taken away the bread from the week before and put new hot bread out, and now he had that bread from the week before. And that's what he gives to David, to feed David and David when he goes back to his men. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. Now just in one verse here, stuck in the midst of this, is this statement about Doeg, the Edomite, and this is an ominous kind of statement here. There's a snake in the grass in this whole situation. Everything that's about to unfold, this is foreshadowing something bad is going to take place. One of Saul's servants is there. One of Saul's chief herdmen is there, and he's witnessing this, and he's hearing this, and it's not going to go well. And David said unto Ahimelech, is there not here under thine hand spear or sword? For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If thou wilt take that, take it, for there is no other save that here. And David said, There is none like that. Give it me. Seems like a strange coincidence that the place David goes and asks for a weapon, that the one weapon that would be there is, in fact, the sword of Goliath, who David slew and cut off his head with his own sword. And now here's that sword, and it's making its way back to David so that David will be armed for what follows. And David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul, and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said unto him, Is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? Remember that? Remember this song that they were singing when David came back from his victory? Well, David must realize now as he goes into Achish, he's not flying under the radar. He's not inconspicuous as he goes into this place. They know who he is. And where is he going? Well, he's going into Gath. He's going into to Achish, the king of Gath. He's going into the very place where he had gotten praise for killing those people. So David knows that he could be in trouble here. He's not going to fly under the radar. So notice what he does. And he changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad in their hands and scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. Then said Achish unto his servants, "Lo, you see the man is mad. Wherefore then have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that ye have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" Now, when I read this chapter, I admit so many questions rise to my mind, and I think understanding what's going on greater understanding can come by considering and trying to answer these questions. So many questions come to mind. First of all, where is Nob? What is Nob? Well, it turns out that Nob, it's a city near Jerusalem. The last that we'd known, we hadn't heard of the tabernacle or the place of worship, which this seems to have been a place of worship, if not the actual tabernacle itself. Last we'd known, it was not here in Nob. Nob is a city in the land of Benjamin, which is significant because remember, Saul was a Benjamite. So perhaps Saul had moved the place of worship into his tribe's region. But whatever the case, this seems to be a center of worship, and maybe even the tabernacle itself had been moved here because it talks about showbread. It talks about putting out the bread of the presence, which was done before the Ark of the Covenant. In other words, that bread was signifying bread that was placed before the presence of God. And so he comes to this place, and he comes to Ahimelech. The other thing about Nob turns out to be a very priestly city. There was not just one priest, but this is where many of the priests dwelt. And Ahimelech, among them, he was a priest there. And who is he? Well, it says in another place that he is the son of Ahitub, and Ahitub was the brother of Ichabod, who were told about very early in the book of Samuel. Remember the sons of Eli, the first priest mentioned. He has sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and they were evil, and God ultimately struck them down. But on the day Phinehas dies in the battle of the Philistines, his wife gives birth to a child, and she names that child, "The Glory is Departed," when she hears that the ark of God had been taken on the battlefield. She names him Ichabod, "The Glory is Departed." Well, this was Ichabod's nephew. And therefore, he was the great-grandson of Eli. So this is a priest of the Lord. This is a priest of the Lord, the great-grandson of Eli. And this is who is there when David comes to this place. And it seems like perhaps David could have went many places to go find bread, but he chooses to go here, where there is, it turns out, the sword of Goliath, and there is a priest of the Lord. Well, David, a part of the reason for this is David went not just to get bread, but David also went to be able to inquire of God. David loved and honored the house of God, and David had a true reverence for the Lord, unlike Saul, who is pursuing him. Well, he comes to Ahimelech, and then another question that arises, why is Ahimelech afraid when David comes? So who is David to him? Well, David had been made the captain of Saul's soldiers. David was a general, basically, in Saul's army. He was in charge of the army, but Ahimelech's afraid. Why? Because David was alone, which was very strange. It would be very strange for someone in such a position of leadership and someone who commanded soldiers to show up by himself. Ahimelech perhaps even knew and had heard rumors or maybe knew that there was potentially some conflict between Saul and David. We don't know all that he knows, but we know it says he's afraid. He's afraid because David's alone. David's by himself. That doesn't make sense for David to not have his servants with him. David's men are not even coming into that place with him. They're hiding out somewhere nearby. And David now offers an explanation. And his explanation is very ingenious, perhaps. He says, Saul has sent him on a secret mission. And no one's supposed to know anything about it, and that's why David's alone. And we'll see from this, and we see from many other examples, that David was very clever. David was very adept at using deception in his tactics. We've seen examples of deception, not so much from David himself yet, but we saw that Jonathan deceived Saul. Micah deceived Saul, her father, and used the deception. Well, here now we see David using deception. And then we see David using deception at the end of the chapter as well. A very striking and humorous picture of David at the end of this chapter when he goes into the land of King Achish and he realizes that they know who he is. Oh, this is the one that slew tens of thousands. Tens of thousands of whom? Of Philistines, of them. And so David realizes he's in trouble. So he pretends to be a crazy person. He lets the drool fall down his chin into his beard. He raves, he's drawing on the doorposts, and he gives a very convincing display. And the king basically responds of, why did you bring me this crazy person? Well, better to be perceived as a crazy person for David than to be perceived as a fierce military threat to their well-being. And so it's interesting. We will see, and we will see more examples of David using deception. And so it raises the question for me, first of all, why? Why does David lie to Ahimelech? And is it justified for David to do so in this case? Now, that deception is justified in certain cases, I believe, is clearly evidenced in the scriptures. And when it is particularly for this reason. Deception is used often in war, but particularly in a circumstance when it is done to save the righteous, the life of the righteous, from the hand of the wicked. So, for example, in the time of Pharaoh, the evil Pharaoh that wanted to kill all the Israelite children when Moses was born, the Hebrew midwives made up a lie, a deception, in order to save the lives of the Hebrew children from getting killed by Pharaoh. And they are commended for that. In the time of Joshua, when the spies come into Jericho, they're hid by Rahab the harlot, and she lies and deceives the guards of Jericho in order to protect the lives of the spies, and she is justified in doing so. We've already seen in Samuel several times, Jonathan deceives Saul in order to save the life of David. Micah, David's wife, deceives her father Saul in order to save the life of David. Abraham lies to the king in his day, telling the king that Sarah was his sister in order to protect his own life and the well-being of Sarah. And so we see that many times that deception is justified, especially in times of war, but particularly to preserve the life of the righteous from the hand of the wicked. But I think we have to be careful. And I think we see an example from the life of David. We see examples that David was very good at deceiving. And sometimes the consequences of that or the usefulness of that tool that he had in his tools of strategy ultimately could be used for evil as well as good. In this case, it's maybe a little less clear than it is later when he uses deception in order to hide and cover up his own sin, which we could see is clearly wrong. In this case, we might say perhaps David was trying to protect Ahimelech. By telling him this story, he was not bringing Ahimelech into the conspiracy. He was giving him cover that he thought, perhaps, that this might be able to be used by Ahimelech to justify himself if he was ever questioned on what happened. Well, we'll have to reserve some judgment on that until we come to the next chapter at a future time, because we will see the consequences of David's actions and his deception unfold as things go on. But I do find that quite fascinating how David is so quick to tell this story that is ultimately deceiving the priest of the Lord, and we will see later consequences that follow from this. Well, we come then to the bread. David eats the bread, the holy bread, which was apparently contrary to the law. Now, specifically, Leviticus chapter 24. In Leviticus chapter 24, verses 5 through 9, it describes this bread and what the priest was to do with it. Leviticus 24, verses 5 through 9. "And thou shalt take fine flour and bake 12 cakes thereof. 2/10 deals shall be in one cake, and thou shalt set them in two rows, 6 on a row, upon the pure table before the Lord." So this bread was to be put out in the presence of God. They would do this every Sabbath day. And it was placed. It was a sacrifice to the Lord. It was an offering to God. "And thou shalt put pure frankincense upon each row, that it may be on the bread for a memorial, even an offering made by fire unto the Lord. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. And it shall be Aaron's and his sons," the priests, Aaron and his sons are the priests, "and they shall eat it in the holy place, for it is most holy unto him of the offerings of the Lord made by fire by a perpetual statute." Well, we come to understand that this is the bread that in fact was given to David. Now, the priest ultimately makes allowance. He makes some stipulation that the men had kept themselves at least from women, perhaps with some kind of understanding that they had to at least have been ceremonially clean, to some level of understanding that the priest had. And David also argues, that the bread is in a manner common. Interesting. He's making interpretations of the law. He's saying even though this was holy bread, it's now become more common because it has been taken off and it's been replaced with the new bread that is now put out. And he argues this. So I would ask, why was this okay? Was this okay, first of all, for David and his men? Because he's going to take this bread and he's going to take it back to his men and feed them as they're fugitives. Was this okay? Well, I think clearly we have the evidence from the teaching of Jesus that this was okay, that they were blameless, as Jesus describes his disciples were, guiltless for what they had done. So why is okay? Well, perhaps, for one, because it's more important to God that his people not go hungry than it is to follow that particular stipulation of the law. Perhaps it's because it's David. And David was chosen by God for this very circumstance, to be persecuted by Saul ultimately, and ultimately to be raised up. In other words, perhaps in many respects, this this situation presented itself for the purpose of David being provided for in this very circumstance. And to a greater degree, we see ultimately, this is pointing us to Jesus and what he would teach, that the stipulations of the law, the regulations that God gave, were not ultimately to teach us how picky God is, but they were given to us to prepare God's people for and to point us to Jesus, who was the purpose and the fulfillment of the law that God gave. Not David himself, ultimately, was the fulfillment and purpose, but David points us to his son, his greater son, Jesus, for whom is the whole purpose that the law was given. It says the law was our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. And the imagery there is that when God's people were in our infancy, which we are described as being under the old covenant times, we were treated like children. We were treated like children who were under a schoolmaster, but the purpose of that was not ultimately the schoolmaster itself, but to prepare us for what would come, that is maturity in the faith. The maturity in the faith is achieved only in Jesus Christ. Like it says in Ephesians, when it talks about how God's working in his people and we're called to speak the truth in love till we all come into the fullness of the measure of the stature of Jesus Christ. Jesus is the purpose of the law. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. He's the reason for it. He's greater than the temple. He's greater than David. He's greater than all of those things. And so I think as we consider this, we begin to understand perhaps a little bit of what it means when it would say later that God would say, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. Well, the priest here had mercy on David and his men. He provided them the bread so that they wouldn't go hungry and they're able to go away. But as we saw, as we pointed out earlier, this story isn't over yet. There's a foreshadowing here. It mentions this man Doeg, an Edomite. He's the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. It says he was detained before the Lord. People speculate, why was he detained? Was he a prisoner? Maybe he had some vow. Maybe because it was the Sabbath, he was not journeying. But for whatever reason, there he is, and he's in that place, and it turns out that he witnessed what took place. And later on, we're going to see he's going to go back to Saul, and he's going to tell Saul what unfolded here. It goes on to describe how David gets the sword of Goliath. And then perhaps because he had realized that Doeg was there, for whatever reason, David arises and says he fled that day for fear of Saul. So he doesn't hang out long. He knows he needs to keep moving. He's going to remain a fugitive for quite some time. In the chapters that follow, and we're going to see the experience of David and ultimately the men that come and join themselves to him as he is a fugitive from Saul and what would happen. He also then makes a very peculiar choice. In hiding out from Saul and running from Saul, he doesn't go just anywhere. He goes to the Philistines. He goes right into the heart of the enemies of the Israelites, of his own enemies, of the ones he had been sung in praises of fame for slaying thousands and tens of thousands of them. And he goes there, and they recognize who he is. Is not this David, the king of the land? They notice something beyond even just that David was a great warrior. But they seem, perhaps, to recognize that David is, in fact, the legitimate king of the land of Israel. Is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s? And David laid up these words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. He knows he's found out. He knows he's discovered. He feigns himself as crazy. And then, as we'll see in what follows in future chapter, that he gets out of there as quick as he can.